What we've been talking about is very much picked up by the recent book by Hugh McKay, Reinventing Australia. Hugh McKay's book, most of you would know, has sort of become a classic. It's the in-book to read. I don't think Hugh McKay is saying anything particularly profound. It's like, as you read the book, it's like watching a home video. He's saying what all of us really knew, but nobody had actually got around to saying. And I think that's the strength of his writing. But he talks in his Reinventing Australia about the seven big issues that Australians have to face. And one of them is with respect to women. And let me just quote a couple of things from his book. For example, he says, when the latest wave of feminism hit Australia in the early to mid-1970s, Australian women experienced what felt like an astonishing awakening. And here comes a remarkable sentence. They discovered that a woman was a person. They discovered that a woman was a person. That's all. That was the heart of the entire revolution. I'm a person entitled the same sense of identity and the same status in our society as any other person. Not a very radical proposition on reflection, but it was one which has led to some of the most revolutionary changes in the Australian way of life this century. I dare say.
We have a bit of lighting, we can't see.
Oh, okay, sorry.
The lights are on here somewhere.
Are they?
Yeah. You said just keep trying to move until you get the right one. But we can't see you or the board.
Someone should actually set these rooms up, I think.
Yeah, they should have.
How's that? Okay.
Yeah, that's better.
How's that? That's better.
Probably better for you too.
Okay. I thought it looked a bit dark there. So it was the most remarkable revolution, just simply that understanding that I'm a woman. He goes on, in the period from the mid-70s to the early 90s, Australian labour market statistics were rewritten. In 1970, 32% of married women were in the workforce. By 1990, that figure had risen to 53% of all married women and 60% of all mothers with dependent children. Whether we like it or not, that is the change. I love this sentence, this paragraph. Some women are deciding the best way to secure male participation in the housework is to offer constant praise, recognition and encouragement. Others have begun to realise that men actually do not know how to perform many household tasks, which women regard as routine. And so some women are now taking a step back from their strident demands for more male participation and are beginning a training program, which will make it easier for their husbands to participate more actively in household management. Wise statement. Sons as well, eh? And here comes, I think, another profound statement in the book. Women's redefinition of gender roles is essentially about power. Women no longer wish to live in a society which men are seen as manipulating all the most obvious levers of power. The traditional view of women captured in such folklore as the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world is no longer enough. Being the power behind the throne has struck women as being less attractive than having equal access to the power of the throne itself. Rather than being the woman positioned behind every successful man, women see no reason why the limelight should not be equally available to a successful person of either gender. And I think the key statement for me is that the whole movement is women discovered that they were a person. I think they always knew that, but the non-person role has been challenged. And that's what we have to do, challenge the non-person role. And of course that comes out in a number of ways. I was watching the induction of our state president, Edward Yu, who's a great guy and a good friend of mine in New South Wales. He's a Chinese man, Edward. It's our first ethnic president. But a friend of mine, John Bruck, some of you might know, who's now the minister of Mortdale Baptist Church, is an ex-Mormon. And I can always remember John saying to me, the thing that was always going to beat the Mormon churches, that they're a group of people run by old men. Because of all the prophets, and you had to be about 90 to get there. And I'll never forget that induction service, because up on the platform for the induction of Edward Yu, all the past presidents came up, and other people came up, and it was a great gathering and people that we should respect. But if there was one out of 25 people under 60 on the platform, I'd be surprised. We are in danger of being run by old men. Now, that's not being disrespectful. Old men have pretty much a place, but we have to ensure that it's balanced with younger and with women. And of course, last night itself was a great night, and and it was a great occasion, from going to one president to the other. And I was at a gathering later where flowers were presented, which is wonderful, but I wonder when we're going to present a box of chocolates to the spouse of the woman president rather than the flowers to the spouse of the male president. When I was in Russia recently, one of the things that interested me is if you go to a Russian church, you'll find that women all sit on one side and men sit on the other side, and children still sit down the front. This is in Baptist and Pentecostal, particularly if you get out into the country, independent or registered. The amazing thing is that the women wear scarves as they're married, because that lets the guys know who's available. And we would be ministering and sharing in the universities and with lawyers and judges, and some of them would follow us to church. And they'd be well-dressed, you know, just normal sort of women who are professional women, well-attired with makeup and whatever, and they'd walk straight into that church. And of course, they were gone. They were being hustled over one side, if the husband was with them over the other, they were being looked at because of their makeup and their dress and attire, because no one had makeup on or whatever, and they would come to us afterwards saying, we cannot go to this church. We don't want to go to the Orthodox church, we don't relate to liturgy, but we cannot go here. And of course, that made me realise that isn't our problem one that is not as quite profound, but is just the same? Many women in our society, particularly in the 30 to 55 age group who've achieved and professional, will not sit in our male-dominated patriarchal structures. They will not sit in them. Today, as we move on, we're going to look at three women, if we have time. And these three women in Genesis had a wrong focus. That's the beauty of Genesis. Whether you're male or female, you're shown up warts and all. There's no discrimination. Just as we saw Abraham yesterday had real troubles, and due respect to Tony, wasn't the happy little fellow we heard last night. Abraham was a real monster at times with Sarah, his wife. But irrespective of that, when we look at these three women, we also discover that these women are also displayed warts and all. They are women with wrong focus. And the first one we're going to look at is Lot's wife. A woman with a wrong focus. And her wrong focus was she kept on looking back to things the Lord had called her from. That's her story. She kept on looking back to things that the Lord had called her from. Would you please turn your Bibles to Genesis chapter 19? And with this one, as with yesterday, I'll ask you to read the first verses yourself, verses 1 to 26 of Genesis chapter 19. Everyone can look onto a Bible. If you can't, because you raise your hand, I'm sure someone near you will be able to hand a Bible to you. Genesis 19, 1 to 26. Let's just take a few moments to read this. Tape? No, the tape hasn't gone bung. We're just reading Genesis 19, 1 to 26. Okay, here's a story of a woman who kept on looking back to the things God had called her from. She looked back, she ached for Sodom. And I think this passage is about the Lord is saying, I'm calling you from Sodom, do not look back on what I am calling you from. And isn't that so true for many of us? We've been called in the kingdom of God, we've been called to leave behind things, perhaps things that are not bad in themselves. Job, vocation, perhaps things that are wrong in themselves. A relationship, a lust, something in our life that we know we shouldn't have there. We've been called by God, but we keep on creeping back. We keep on looking back. We keep on desiring the things that we have been called from. Now, what was Lot's wife looking back at? What would really take her attention with respect to Sodom? Well, one, of course, that comes out of this passage very clearly is the sexual permissiveness of Sodom itself. They are a society that even condone homosexuality, and of course the word sodomy comes from the word Sodom. And they're very blatant about their homosexual behaviour. Look at chapter 19. Two angels arrive at the city gate. Remember there the two fires we saw from yesterday from Genesis chapter 18. Remember what we said about angels? That was great what Tony Campolo said last night. He prayed for people with their guardian angels. Great stuff. The world loves that. That's great unchurched language. People are into angels. The two angels arrive. They are clearly not ordinary folk. Genesis is making that clear. They come from Mamre in Genesis chapter 18 to Sodom. That's about 40 miles. and they've done it from the heat of the day, that's from midday until evening. So they've done that in an afternoon. They've travelled 40 miles by foot in the afternoon. These are not ordinary guys. They're strange visitors. They arrive at Sodom in Genesis 19. They arrive, and look what happens. Here's Lot's, Abraham's nephew, sitting in the gate, sitting in the obvious centre of the entrance into the city, and the gateway was a position of honour. So Lot is a person who has honour. He doesn't know who these characters are, but he knows Sodom. He knows what it's all about. And he encourages them to come home with him and stay the night with him and leave early in the morning while it's dark so the men in the town can't see these two young fellows going home. And look what they say in verse 2. Oh no, we think we'll stay here and we'll spend the night sleeping out here and we'll be okay. We'll spend the night in the square. I mean, Lot's jaw must have dropped. He knew what was going to happen to them. They spent the night in the square, and it happened anyway. The men of the town turned up and wanted to have sexual intercourse with them. Now, most of you will know that when verse 5 says sexual intercourse, or it does in my NIV, the literal translation is they wanted to know them. And so some, particularly with a homosexual acceptance, have said no, they didn't want to have sexual intercourse with them. All they wanted to do was know them, to find out if they were aliens or spies, to check them out. Well, that's pretty hard in the context, isn't it? When he offers these virgins to them in replacement, I mean, really, what some people will go to rather than face off with the word of God is squarely saying. So, what happens? Lot does an incredible thing himself. He's called righteous in 2 Peter 2:7. I respect the word of God since he's fired. He obviously had a right relationship with God and was obviously right with God in many ways. But this guy is unbelievable. He offers his two daughters to replace the two men. And somehow this is not condoned by the narrator. He does it. And look at the impact what happens after that. Look what Lot's daughters end up doing because their husband don't come. And they end up on their own with their father. They end up having sexual intercourse with their father. Can one wonder why? The sort of standards that have been set in Sodom and the sort of behaviour by Lot himself when he offers his daughters to appease the crowd. So, out they go and these guys, angels, warn them and they leave. And they do, and the place is destroyed. Some of us might say, who would want to look back on such an environment, being called for such a location? Well, I mean, the sexual state of society is something that many people find attractive. You only have to watch many of the sex programs that are on TV at 9:30 in the sense of, you know, all the details about sex you always want to know and weren't told, to see how popular they are and how high they rate. I mean, people are interested in the sexual permissiveness of our society. Well, I mean, I even noticed the other day the young liberals were saying that they wanted X-rated videos available to all people. Don't they understand it's the most degrading thing to women? I mean, who are these young liberals? I mean, where are they coming from? But some people just find this sort of stuff appealing. And I'm sure that many men, if we look at our own history, the sad story of Keith Wright, we discover a person who couldn't leave something God had called him to leave behind. One of the tragic stories, isn't it? Recent Baptist leadership and political leadership in this country. Lot's wife wanted to look back, no doubt, at the sexual permissiveness of that society. She found it attractive. What else did she want to look back at? Well, we also find that in the Word of God, if you turn to Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 49 and 50, that this was a comfortable place to live. It was a comfortable place to live. Ezekiel 16... 49 and 50, where we read this. Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore I did away with them as you have seen. A comfortable place to live. By the way, some people cast aspersions on Lot's wife being turned into a pillar of salt and saying, I mean, that sort of stuff can't happen. I mean, it's an interesting story. If you actually look at around that area today, I mean, geologists find that there's a great deal of petroleum and they've known that for some time. And if you actually look at some of the other areas, you'll find that bitumen's mentioned in Genesis 14, there's sulfur mentioned in Genesis chapter 19, there's dense smoke mentioned in Genesis chapter 19. And many people believe what went on there now, from their own geological perspective, is that, and salt of course is known around the mount called Sodom by the Arabs. It's 150 feet deep at the foot of the mount, a lot of salt. And of course Sodom is now known to be in the lower part of the Dead Sea, the southern part, where it's only about 18 feet, that's where the cities were. So what most people believe now, there was some sort of volcanic eruption or some sort of earthquake, and the petroleum and was ignited, the gases, and everything was thrown up in the air, the bitumen, the salt and whatever, and clearly fell upon Lot's wife. That's what God allowed to happen. And the dense smoke, many see, is a sign of that whole petroleum sort of explosion. Anyway, when you get here in Ezekiel, you'll find that what you've got going on here is you've got a city that is comfortable. People are comfortable, they've got no concern for the needy, they're overfed, and they live that life, and they're hoardy, and they are detestable. And she was called to leave a city where people were comfortable. And let me say to you, as I say to myself today, I think that's one of the greatest problems we as Christians have. We keep on looking back to the comforts of life. We don't want to leave behind our material possessions or material outlook on life. When I was in Russia recently, I hate to keep on mentioning it, but one of the things that really struck me, I was able to go with a guy called Major John Rees, who is a Salvation Army person, and he's an Australian. And he's working in Moscow, and he's running the Salvation Army work in the whole of Russia. And he works from Moscow. And do you know, in one railway station in Moscow last year, in one railway station alone, 150 people died of cold and tuberculosis. In one railway station alone. They're living on the stations. He took me down. They're living on the stations. Who is there? Because the government doesn't acknowledge any of this. Major John Rees from Australia and a few Salvation Army people have only been there for a few years. They're down there with their soup kitchen. They're down with their clothing. They're down there ministering and caring for these people. Major John Rees also took me to a home that's the first home that's begun for destitute and street kids in Moscow. And I went into this home, and it's in a back street, and the whole street's basically falling in, and there's wire cables that are live out the front of the house. It's just an unbelievable place. And in that, he's already got boys between 6, 8 and 9 who are just physically abused. You can see the black marks on their bodies. And they just sleep there at night and back on the streets. He's doing things in the jails, and he needs dentists to go over there to help him in the jails, because there's no dentists in the jails, and those who are doing the work on the prisoners' teeth and the kids of prisoners, they're using the same drill bit 8, 9, 10, 11 times. And you can all imagine what health impact that can have. Friends, we cannot be comfortable in this world. I could take you down to Gomel Prison, where I had the privilege of preaching. And it's a prison of women, and it's in Belarus, and it's the largest prison in the country of Belarus. And to see 700 women who turned up to a gathering that we had, and we had the opportunity of preaching, and to see hundreds of women come forward and respond to the gospel was an amazing thing. But then to have to pray for a woman who was having her leg amputated the next day, and there was no anaesthetic. Or to be there this time with a couple of my parliamentarian mates, and to be in that prison and to see a whole ward of women who need tuberculosis, got tuberculosis and need antibiotics, and there's just none there. And you know what the obscene thing is? We incinerate our used by drugs in this country. We incinerate them. And they don't have any. You go into that place, which is the heart of the Chernobyl fallout, and you take in your basic aspirins and whatever, and they just line up to take them. We cannot be in a society anymore where we are comfortable. We have an obligation to give and to be involved in the world until it hurts. Jesus said, if you follow me, you take up your cross. When you give a drink of water to those, you do it in my name. No. Sodom was a comfortable place to live. Lot's wife liked it. There was no obligation to care for the poor, the needy, anybody else but yourself, and to live life that way. She wanted to look back. It was too costly to live any other. Also, if you look at Jeremiah chapter 23:14, there's an interesting little reference about Sodom. So I've tried to sort of assess in my own way. Jeremiah 23:14, and it says, "And among the prophets of Jerusalem I have seen something horrible. They commit adultery and live a lie. They strengthen the hands of evildoers so that no one turns from his wickedness. They are all like Sodom to me. The people of Jerusalem are like Gomorrah. They commit adultery and live a lie. So I would say to you that not only was Sodom a place which was sexually permissive and anything went, it was also a place which was comfortable and you could live arrogant and have no concern for anybody else who had needs. It was also a place where the lie was the way of life. It was expedient. You just lied. And of course that's the sort of society that many of us live in today. I mean, it's just common knowledge now. I mean, politicians lie. It's expedient. I mean, there's no obligation to tell the truth. And so often we find ourselves in situations where the employer will lie to the employee about his job or employment because it suits his business. Or spouses perhaps lie and say, I love you, and at the same time they're doing something on the side. We live in a society where to lie, to be expedient, to hide one's own truthful condition, and to live out a lie is a comfortable place to be. That's what she was called to leave behind, that sort of environment. But she had the wrong focus. She wouldn't. She kept on wanting to look back. And the Lord is saying to me, as I read the story of Lot's wife, he's saying to me, Ross, what are you looking back at? What are the things you've been called to leave behind? Is it an area in sexual pleasure? Is it an area of your own comfort? You've lost the understanding of dying to self and living for the world? Is it just a hypocritical life with respect to your children, your wife, your family? What is he calling you to leave behind? Lot's wife looked back. And folks, it's dangerous to look back. In God's economy, it's dangerous to look back. Eve also had a long focus, and she's a fascinating woman. Her focus was not looking back on the things that she had been called to leave behind. Her focus, I believe, was looking to live a life without God in control. I mean, when you read the story of Adam and Eve, do you think that you'll find Adam and Eve in heaven? I mean, are they the tyrants of the Bible? Hands up those who think they will find, when they read the story of Adam and Eve, will find Eve in heaven. Hand up those who say no. Hand up those who refuse to judge. They're theologically correct. Well, I don't know, but I think the tip is that they will be. For example, look at a couple of references when you get home. Look at Genesis chapter 3, 21, and you'll see that God still cares. And in Genesis 3, 24, you see that he keeps the garden open. But the interesting thing is that you'll see that when, at the beginning and end of Genesis, when Eve has children, she says, with the help of the Lord I brought forth a man. So even after the fall, she's still saying, with the help of the Lord. And of course, it's the parents who Adam and Eve introduce their children to the sacrifice system to God that then takes place in Genesis chapter 4. So, I mean, the clear evidence is that there is a relationship with the Lord that is continuing in Genesis chapter 4 after Genesis chapter 3. So my feel is that, yes, they are not seen as the banished couple. And God did some remarkable things for Eve and for Adam. Look, for example, in Genesis 2, verse 7. The Lord formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. Now, you know, we still came from dust. That's important. Like the rest of creation, we came from dust. Or as Paul Davy says, stardust. I mean, we are linked with nature. It's beautiful, that's stardust. We are linked with nature. I mean, we come from dust. We return to dust. We are that interconnected, but we are different in the sense that God breathed into us. This is a spiritual dimension. We were not just physical. He gave us a spiritual dimension to life. This is what it's saying. As Jesus breathed on the disciples in the upper room, God breathed upon us and gave us a spiritual dimension. So they are blessed. They have a spiritual dimension. They are also blessed because they have each other. Verse 18, the Lord God said, it is not good for man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him. Now that helper comes up in the next couple of verses, and many of you would know and say, well, there you are. The woman's role is to be a helpmate, to be a helper, to be subservient, and to serve the male. Well, Dr. Helen Clements and others have certainly put a real stopper on that. You'll know that that word in the Hebrew appears, Helen Clements has found, 27 times in the Old Testament, and when it appears 27 times, 15 times it appears in relationship to God. God is our helper. Same word. It's God subservient to you? You've got a problem if you're going to apply that word to Eve, because it's also the same word that's used of God to us 15 times in the Bible. God's subservient to no one. So, helper just simply means someone who's going to share the life with Adam. So they have each other. And there's a great little poem. This one, if you look down in verse 23, when Adam has his helper, he says, this one. That's literally, this one. And it's the first, there's actually 13 words in the poem, and the first, the seventh, and the 13th word is this one. You know, Adam's saying, yes, this is the person I'm going to live my life with. This one, this one, this one. God has given me a partner. So God was gracious. He gave them a spiritual dimension. He gave them each other. More than that, he gave them a garden. That's great. And that comes out in verses 8 and 9. Now, the Lord had planted a garden in the east, in Eden, and Eden just simply means, desire, something great, delight. He gave them a garden in the east in Eden, and of course that garden we call paradise, because the Greek translation of that word in the old Hebrew Bible, Septuagint, is similar to our English word for paradise. But he gave them a garden. So they've got each other, they've got a spiritual dimension, and they've got a garden. By the way, I'm sorry to keep on talking about New Ages, but New Ages love this stuff. They absolutely love it. There's trees in the garden. Iliardi, for example, the great religious explorer and investigator of religious ideas, says in almost every religious tradition there's a cosmic tree. The cosmic tree. And the Druids, for example, also had a cosmic tree. And they saw a tree as sacrifice, and they called it Jesus. That was the name they gave the tree. And so when Jesus came along, the Druids saw sacrifice tree. This name sounds similar to Jesus. They could see the whole thing lining up. So if you're dealing with the New Ages, they love the story of Genesis, because they understand that these sort of stories are found in all religious traditions. They are inherent in the human ache that we had a paradise that we lost. It's an inherent story. It's taken up with the Sleeping Beauty myth. It's an inherent story. We have something we lost. We go into darkness, fallenness. The prince comes and rescues us. Well, like C.S. Lewis, we have to rediscover that stuff. If you want to preach today in a popular evangelistic way, preach myth. I'm not saying this is myth. Some of you might believe that, some of you don't. I'm not saying that, but preach the myth. Preach the stories of paradise and lost and regained. Because New Ages believe it's an inherent thing that's found in the ache of the human condition. So, not only did God give them the garden, and that he gave them vocation. And that's seen in verses 15 to 20. And Adam, for example, is cultivating the land and whatever. And most of you know that as a result of the fall, all of that got lost, didn't it? I mean, their relationship got messed up. They were thrown out of the garden. The eternal life that they had in the garden was lost. The job became hard. Adam was going to rule over Eve. Notice that is a fallen condition, not a redeemed condition. The whole thing that God gave them was mixed up. The orders he'd given them, marriage, a place to live, and a vocation, and even their spiritual dimension, because they were now thrown out of the garden where the eternal tree of life was. What caused this? Well, I think you'll find that Genesis 3 tells us a story. Eve had a wrong focus. What was her wrong focus? She ate of the tree of good and evil. What's that all about? Well, I think it's a tree in a sense of a sacrament, like communion or baptism is a sacrament of our belonging to God. This tree was a sacrament, a sacramental sign. As long as you didn't eat of that tree, you're making a sacramental statement that you belong to God and did things his way. But the moment you ate that tree, you're making a statement that you will now take control of your life in determining what was good and right for you. And so by eating of the tree, I believe that Eve made a commitment to live her life knowing there was a God, but with herself in control. I will make the decisions now. Wrong focus. And I think that's one of the sad things that's happened in contemporary spirituality. You see, why is it that when we look at women's magazines, for example, you pick up Women's Day, New Idea, why is it they are full of New Age material and spirituality? Absolutely full of them. I mean, in the next class in the seminar, I'll be showing you 8-page tarot lift-outs in Women's Day and Women's Weekly. How to read fortune-telling. 8-page lift-outs. When's the last time you got an 8-page lift-out in any of the women's magazines on how to read your Bible? The New Weekly comes in, and what's it got? Oral readings, everything. It's full of it. Why don't the women in Australia write and say, we don't want any more of this stuff? How about giving us, you know, a five-page lift out on how to read the Bible and to pray, and we'll get a woman to write it? Why are we letting it happen? It's got to come from women, not from men, even though we're men are the ones who read the magazines often, but it's got to come from women. Why are all these things happening? If you listen to 2UE in Sydney, the Sydney's top rating program, on a Sunday night, the rating show at the moment has been the same for the last 2 years. Something like 21% of the people who are listening to radio on Sunday night in Sydney listen to a clairvoyant. All Sunday night. Do you know there's two great radio programs on, Christian radio programs on 2CH and 2GB, and their combined ratings don't get equal to what's happening to 2UE. More people in Sydney on a radio station on Sunday night are listening to a clairvoyant than all the Christian radio put together. Thousands upon thousands. Why? Because people are searching for something which New Age allows them to have, and that's basically they set their own destiny. The bottom line of New Age is, those who come to the seminar will see, we are basically one with the universe, we are one with the Spirit, we ourselves are God, we set our own destiny. A little bit different from Eve, she still saw herself separate from God, but basically the same line was, I want to take control of my life. That's what New Age is about. I want to set my own path, discover my own spiritual destiny, I want control, I want to do it in my own strength. Oh yes, certainly, yep. I'm not dismissing Satan, no. He certainly encourages Satan as the father of lies, and that's what he'll continue to do, and deceive people to that whole belief that they control their own life and the whole spiritual path. What I'm trying to stress, though, is that one thing that we... magazines that sell 800,000 copies, why is what's happening on radio, TV and elsewhere, why is it so attractive to women? Because I'd suggest to you that many women from the 30 to 60 age group are looking for non-patriarchal spirituality. And if we do not hear this, we are in real strife. Listen to me. Read the magazines. Why are they there? Because that's what women want. There's no other reason. It's dominating. Try and find one Christian article in the lot of magazines that come out this month, and to compare it with the 20 or 30 pages of New Age material you'll discover. And that was happening with Eve. The same particular situation was happening for her. She wanted to control her own destiny. She wanted to be one who set the rules and the guidelines. And of course she was tempted by Satan, and she took that. The oldest lie continues today. So I'd encourage you all not to fall for that lie, and even if it's today, that we are the ones who set our own agenda spiritually. And of course, I mean, New Age is very tragic, because in the end they rely on human mediums, and they rely on their own self, and they rely on crystals to achieve their ultimate end, when they could go straight to God. But it's something we need to hear. Interesting, of course, Eve has been cast as a scapegoat in all of this search for a life where she is in control and God isn't. Of course, she's been cast as a scapegoat. Many see Paul doing that, of course, in 1 Timothy 2 and elsewhere. Let me say that that whole area of Eve being the scapegoat as the one who led the whole human race into sin is one that has been taken up, and it's one that feminists see as something that is common in Christian literature. In fact, I could read a quote to you if I had time, and it's just to say another quote from an article. Someone put a story in the Australian Baptist, and it's just recording it. It's an interesting story, and it's about when drink came into the city, and that in New South Wales, and the closing time was left to be till 10 o'clock. And the article goes on and says, we've got to protect our women from this. They are the key. As Satan the serpent tempted Eve, so they will be tempted to leave our society in despair through alcohol. In other words, they will be the weak link in all of this that will take us all down the track. The scapegoat. And those who think that Paul's using a scapegoat when he talks in Timothy in justifying women being silent because of the role of Eve, you need to remember that Paul is making a point there, and at the same time he can very much make Adam a scapegoat in Romans 5 and tell you that sin came in the world through Adam. And he can also in Galatians 3:28 tell you there's no difference between male and female. If we want to use Paul as an example, make sure that we give the hiding to men that he also gives, as well as the hiding he gives to women. He shows no favour. Read Romans 5 and see he's responsible for the sin that's in the world. I think Paul's point is that we're all responsible. We're all responsible. So Eve had the problem of having a wrong focus. She was one who was looking to control her life, even though she knew there was a God. But she wanted control. And finally, Rebecca. She's a great woman. I mean, she's a very generous woman, a very kind woman, a woman who stands tall in history. But Genesis chapter 27 gives you a good summary of the story of Rebecca and her role with Jacob and Esau. But as we saw yesterday, just remember what happened in Genesis chapter 25. And you see in verse 23, the Lord said to Rebecca, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. This is amazing. It is, as we said yesterday, what is happening here is the Lord is giving Rebecca the understanding of who will continue the covenant, not giving it to Isaac. There is no indication here that Isaac knew that Jacob had received the birthright. Rebecca's the one who asks what's going on, and Rebecca's given the statement that Jacob will receive the birthright. That's where the covenantal promise will go. And that explains why all the fun and games goes on with Isaac later on, and Isaac doesn't really know what's going on. And you can see what goes on here is Rebecca continues to have some sort of favour towards Jacob. For example, if you look down at verse 28, which is a tragic verse in one sense, Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebecca loved Jacob. In Genesis chapter 27, verses 5 and 6, now Rebecca was listening as Isaac spoke to his son Esau. When Esau left for the open country to hunt game and bring it back, Rebecca said to her son Jacob. The narrator is the only one who ever refers to Esau as being Rebecca's son. Rebecca never refers to Esau as being her son. It's only the narrator. And when it was clearly Rebecca appears to be talking, it's her son. It's always her son, Jacob. So from this sort of situation, there's a favouritism that has developed towards Jacob. So what was Rebecca's problem? I believe Rebecca was looking to follow out God's will, but to do it in her own strength. I mean, she was the one who had the understanding that the line was to continue through Jacob, but what did she do? Rather than let God fill it out and rather than let God do it, she took control of the thing and did it herself. And you have the remarkable story that then goes on, don't you, of what Rebecca then goes and hears that the Isaac is going to give the birthright to Esau, and of course she wants Jacob to get it, believes that's God's will, so she goes out and gets the game and cooks it and puts the wild goat skins on Jacob, and Jacob goes and deceives his father, and his father thinks he's actually dealing with Esau, and the birthright goes to Jacob. You all know the story, don't you? Does God condone that? No. Read Genesis 27. He doesn't think it's good at all. There's no sense that God thinks this is great. Verse 20, for example, and you see that she's all in control, and you see through Genesis chapter 27 that she's all in control, verses 8 and 9 rather. Now, my son, listen carefully and do what I tell you. Go out to the flock and bring me two choice young goats. She is in control of this. Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. What incredible deception and lies that are going on here. Fulfilling God's will, but doing it in our own strength. Determining to do it in our own strength. So we have three focuses, I believe, that are wrong. Lot's wife, who is looking back at the things God has called her to leave behind. Eve, who is looking to live life, making her own decisions. Living life without a commitment to God. I've had enough. I want to do it my own way. I'm sick of ministry. I want to earn a dollar. Forget it, Lord. I want to take control. I'm tired of the church. I don't want to be there anymore. Eve wanted to take control of her life. and developing, as we see in New Age today, her own spiritual strength and guides and direction and choice. And then, of course, you have Rebecca, who's looking to do God's will in her own strength. A remarkable thing happened to me. A friend of mine who I've been sharing with for many years, he's a lawyer, we work together in the Northern Territory, and he never showed any great interest in Christian things, and married to a nominal Catholic, and he's a nominal Jew. And they're both now reasonably well-known authors in this country. And just very nominal religious belief. And he rang me up about a year or so ago, and he said, "Ross, I want to come and see you." And I said, "Cool, come over for a barbecue." And they came over for a barbecue, and we're having the barbecue, and he said to me, "You know," he said, "I've started reading the Bible." I said, "You've done what?" He said, "I've started reading the Bible." I thought about all the apologetic and evangelism I'd done with him over the years, and nothing, and he's starting to read the Bible. He was starting to adopt a family from another country, a great compassionate heart. He went over to another backward country, got the whole family and brought them back and adopted them. Their mother had died and their father had been shot by rebels in their presence, the kids. And all of this had brought great stress to his life and he couldn't cope. So he started to read the Bible. And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He said, "I just opened up the Bible every day and point my finger at a verse and I read it and that's my verse for the day." Now, well, Ross, the theologian, is just about to correct him on that. And I said, "No, let him go." And he said, "Today, as I was coming over," he said, "I knew I had to see you. I put my finger on a verse and the verse said, 'You need wise counsel.'" And he said, "My wife said to me, 'That means that you need a group of guys who can pray with you. And Ross will have a group. Ask him.'" She said, "Where's the group, mate? I mean, when can we start this prayer?" It just so happened that I'd started about a week beforehand a prayer group in the city with a couple of guys who were then at Guymere. I'd left Guymere, but we'd start this prayer group in the city and we're just meeting and we're praying for some non-saved Christian friends. I said, "You want to come along to that?" He said, "Great, I'll come along to that." I picked him up, I took him to that prayer group, and he sat down in that prayer group and he told his story, and these guys started praying for him, and they were more mature guys, some of these older saints, great guys, good friends of mine, and they were weeping as they were praying. And at the end he said, "God, I don't even know if you exist, but I need you." 2 weeks later he came to the prayer group. Well, I couldn't stop him. He's praying for Aunt Sally and Sister Joan, and he's praying for the world, and he's praying for everything else. And then he moved out of Sydney. He moved out of Sydney, but he basically, in his own way, not my way, made a commitment to God. He rang me up the other day and he said, "Mate, God has told me, you know," he said, "you know that thing, that adoption of those children that I've got? You know it's right from God, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've been trying to do it all my own." He said, "I'm almost destroyed. It's taken 3 years. He's fighting with the department. He's got writs in court." He said, "I can't take any more." He said, "I said to God, it's what you want, but you now tell me how to do it." And he said, "Ring Ross." "Oh, thanks, mate." It just so happened that one of the parliamentarians, who's now the government whip, who was going to Russia with me, was over at Morland College that day. The guy faxed me a list of what was happening. I gave it to him, and then he gave it to the minister. I didn't know he was going to give it to the minister. He just wired over to the minister. I mean, the Lord works in marvellous ways. It also happened that minister had just invited me to speak at the Parliamentary Kingfisher Club that he and another minister puts on for all their non-saved Christian friends. So all of a sudden, I became a name to him. The next minute, the head of the department was on the phone. I mean, you know, the fax wasn't dry. And the guy's on the phone. You won't believe this, but the head of the department, I didn't know, is a guy that I knew 10 years before. We're talking like old mates. The adoption went through the other day in record-breaking time. And the guy said, "Yeah, look, I just knew. I mean, I just knew. God said, ring Ross." And he just hit me again with this thing. So often, like Rebecca, we know what God wants us to do, but we don't let him be part of the doing. Now, I'm not one who just says, let go and let God. I just think I'm not into that. But I am saying we've got to make sure that we're allowing God to work in our life. Wrong focuses. We've got to conclude, but I want to conclude with a story. One or two of you might have heard it before, because it really touched my life. Like perhaps very few things have. It concerned a woman, and Margaret here from Guymere will know the story. This woman was a lady that nobody, as I could understand, liked. Her husband had left her. Her daughter didn't talk to her. She had no friends that we were aware of in the community. She used to ring me because she wanted legal advice on her breakup with her husband, and she somehow got my name and thought I might be some free advice. But she would never listen to you, never take advice. She was a noxious woman, and she had a very selfish self-focus. Her whole life was focused on herself. That's all that she lived for. A remarkable thing is, I put a lady deacon in our church in touch with her, and she started sharing with her. And the lady deacon came to me one morning and said, guess what? On Sunday, so-and-so is coming to church for the first time. I said, well, that's interesting. Why? She said, it's a healing service. I said, oh, yeah. She said, she's got advanced leukemia. She's coming for prayer. This woman's not a Christian. I thought, oh, yeah, okay. We run a healing service. I mean, nothing dramatic. We just call people forward, and we just pray for them and lay on hands. I mean, once a month or whatever. This woman came forward. I met her for the first time, was introduced to her by this lady deacon. I prayed for her and she left the service. The Tuesday I had a phone call from the hospital, St. George Hospital, to say, could you please come down to intensive care? Mrs. So-and-so is down there and she's only got a matter of hours to live and she's asked to see you. So I jumped in the car and drove off and said, well, Lord, that's a great healing service. I've got pretty powerful hands, no doubt about that. Got down to the intensive care and I couldn't get in. There was a queue like this waiting to get in intensive care. There was some emergency in intensive care. I couldn't get in. I waited for about half an hour, thought I can't wait any longer. I had appointments in the city. So I started to leave. I walked out of the intensive care room and started walking down the corridor and I heard this voice behind me and this fellow yelled out, Ross, Ross! And I turned around and it was a doctor. He was a handsome bloke. He looked like me. He had a beard, dark hair. And he also had my name. Ross, and about my age. I'd played a bit of cricket with him, but for the first time he came to church that Sunday. The same Sunday. For the first time he came to our church. And he came down to me and he said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm trying to see Mrs. So-and-so. I can't get in because of the emergency. He said, don't worry, she's my patient. I'll take you in. I'm saying, hey, something's going on here. I walk in and sit down with this woman, and for some reason, the fact that her doctor and now her minister look alike and have the same name was a great comfort to her. I do not know why, but for some reason it was a comfort for her. I took her hand and I said, do you want to give your life to Jesus? Do you want to just pray to God? She said, I don't know if I believe in God and Jesus. Now, the apologist Ross was just about to give her the evidences for the resurrection, but I thought it wasn't appropriate. And I said, look, basically, I said, cut the crap. Do you want to give your life to God or not? She said, yes, I do. And we prayed a very, very simple prayer. We held hands, the three of us. I think we might have kissed and we left. A couple of days later, I'm doing a funeral. It's cremation. There was about two people there. She had no friends, a selfish person, isolated most people. Her former husband turned up and her daughter was there who didn't want to talk to me, just left. And the husband came up to me and I said, I'm sorry. He said, I know the relationship was a really hard one. And I said, I know you had a lot of struggles. He said, mate, don't apologise. He said, I never could have believed what happened. He said, I saw her on Tuesday afternoon, just before she died. And he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, it was a miracle. He said, she looked at me and she said, I am sorry for all the things I did to you in our relationship. And he said, we parted friends. She'd been born again. She had been touched by God. She had been healed and she had a new focus, a focus away from herself and the things that God wanted her to leave behind, a focus to the things of God and the power of God and the fruit of the Spirit of God. Her life had been changed. Lot's wife had a wrong focus, looking back at things being called from. Eve had a wrong focus, I believe. Wanting to do things in her own strength, even knowing there was a God out there wanting to set the agenda. And that's one for me. I get sick and tired of ministry at times, so I just want out. I want to set the agenda. And I know that many ministers' wives and ministers have exactly the same problem. Eve speaks to my heart. And Rebecca, yep. She really wanted to do what God wanted, knew what God wanted in her life, but she just went and did it all. Three remarkable women of history, and through their valleys that have been recorded for us, we get remarkable insights about living life today. Don't be too hard on Lot's wife Eve and Rebecca, because just remember the story of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob.